Welcome to ITE 1, Semester 2, Module 8. This is networking. Before we start, I'm going to give this over to Elise for her quiz on Chapter 7. So take it away.
Thank you, Grace. Good morning, everybody. Well, I hope we've enjoyed our Lecture 7 from last week, because now it's time to find out how much of it you remembered. So let's start. We've only got 7 questions, so it shouldn't be too hard. So everybody, hopefully you've got your chat windows open, and here we go. Which technology is used by dot matrix printers? A, digital drop. B, electrostatic spray. C, electrophotographic. D, ink melting. Or E, impact. Yeah, I haven't got focus on it, but for anybody who said E, which I think were a number of you are correct. Which phase of the laser printing process includes applying toner to the latent image? That's the latent image on the roller, on the drum rather. A, cleaning. B, conditioning. C, developing. D, fusing. Or E, transferring. Go now. Oh, we only got one answer there. Yeah, we got two. Any more? We have two answers. Any other people game enough to try? I know this is a tricky question, so we're not going to jump down your throats if you come back with an incorrect answer. This is what we're here to do. We're here to learn. Note takers, for those people who answered with their answer of C, you are correct. What are three disadvantages of impact printers? I think we might have to do a yes or no on this. Okay, so three disadvantages of impact printers. Expensive consumables. Okay, person who answered no is correct. High power consumption. No takers. Limited color capabilities is yes. I'm just not sure where I'm in the notes now. High power consumption is no for whoever answered no for that. Noisy printing. If anyone would like to have a go. Yep, that's a disadvantage. Slow printing is the disadvantage with an impact printer. The answer is yes, no one's had a go at that. And unable to use continuous feed paper, which is no. So we might as well move on from that. Which type of printer melts ink and sprays it through a nozzle onto a drum to transfer an image onto paper? A, fusion ink. B, impact. C, inkjet. D, laser. E, solid ink. Or F, thermal. Go now. Could be confusing with the last answer, but anyway. Those who got E, and I'm not looking at the screen, solid ink is the correct answer. Okay, which type of printer uses solid sheets of ink which change directly to gas? Remember, there's an interesting new word here when the ink, or when the print hits the ink. Dye sublimation. B, impact. C, inkjet. D, laser. E, solid ink. F, thermal. Yep, it's that wonderful new word, dye sublimation, going from solid directly to gas. You are correct, the people who answered A. So an easy one for you. Which peripheral is used to convert paper document into electronic files? A, digital reader. B, printer. C, projector. Or D, scanner. Well, a bit of a mixed one here. That's interesting. It's a scanner, which is option D, because it converts a piece of paper with text or images on it to an electronic file, which is what they're asking for here. Not what you do with the electronic file at the other end, which may be to print it, and yes, you can print your scanned images. Okay, guys, how is the speed of a laser printer measured? Option A, dots per minute. I'm going to say B, pages per minute, because something's gone wrong with my notes. So let's say B, pages per minute. C, pixels per second. D, pages per second. Or E, pages per week. And we're talking about the speed of a laser printer. The people who got B are correct. Yes, if you had a printer running at one page a week, you'd be in trouble. So that's it for the quiz. Well done, everybody, and it's back to Grace.
Thank you, Elise. Just a note on the quizzes. They're not graded. They're for you to test and see what you need to work on. So it's only hurting yourself if you don't answer the questions. So it's a really good idea to answer. Nobody's going to come after you if you get them wrong. Nobody's going to come after you if you even get them all wrong. It just will let you know that you need to read more of the chapter.
Need to study a bit more.
Yeah, and that's okay. That's what we're here
sometimes,
for.
Sometimes some of the answers that come up do provoke discussion, whether they be right answers or wrong answers. So it's always good to participate.
I remember the first time that we did the Chapter 7 quiz when I was in class. Everybody did really badly. So we all knew that we needed to study the chapter, and we actually repeated this quiz for like 3 weeks until we all had a good understanding of what was going on. And that was actually really good, because printers can be quite a hard subject for us.
I was just going to point out the one with the quizzes. You'll find that a lot of the test, the questions on the quizzes are exactly the same on the quizzes as the questions in the chapter exams. The quizzes are not graded, but the chapter exams are. So here's your chance to get a free run at some of the questions before you hit the chapter exam. It will increase your marks.
All right, testing Autovox. Am I hearable?
You are.
Cool.
Extremely.
Too loud?
Yeah, move the microphone back a little bit.
All right. That better?
Yep.
Sounds good to me.
All right. So this is going to be Chapter 8. It's on networks. Before I start, this is really heavy stuff, guys. So if you get confused, feel free to ask questions. That's why we have these live lectures. Make sure to read your notes. The worksheets are really good hands-on practice for this stuff. And I've got a few tips on the worksheets for everybody. The first one is that these worksheets consist of a few tables. So if you are rusty on your JAWS table commands, you might want to check out the help document. They're pretty easy. Or WindowWise commands, either way, whatever you're using. For people who use JAWS, just a review, Control, Alt, left and right arrow moves you between columns in a row, and Alt, Control, up and down arrow moves you between rows. So there's a very quick and dirty review of a couple of your JAWS table commands that you may find useful when working on these worksheets. Another quick tip, you will be asked to run an ipconfig command, and a universal way of doing this through all operating systems, Vista, Windows 7, yes, it does work on Windows 7, I've checked, XP, I think it even works in 98, but I'm not quite sure. You're going to press Windows R, it's going to take you to the Run dialog box. You're going to type in cmd.exe. You're going to press enter. It's going to give you your command prompt, and you can type in ipconfig space slash all space, and then you can either press space or you can press enter. If you press enter, you're going to get your ipconfig shown to you on the screen. Which is good, but sometimes it'll run off the screen. So what I tend to do is after your ipconfig space slash all, let's press another space, hit greater than, and type in c:\ a file name, and then .txt. Now what this is going to do is dump the ipconfig slash all, dump the results into a text file that will be in the root of your C drive with the file name you specified, and it will open with your preferred .txt editor, which if you haven't changed it should be Notepad, and you'll be able to see everything right on the screen. It won't run off, it'll just be one nice text file for you, and it will make your lab life much easier. If you want, I can write that command out in chat. Oops. Oops, sorry about that. Hold on. Trying again. There we go. I accidentally pressed the enter key instead of the backslash key, and it sent my submission prematurely there. Now, does anyone have any questions on those two tips or not understand what they need to do? Okay, I'll take that as a no. So, without further ado, I am... Okay, hold on just a second. All right, we just had some people that were trying to get something done quickly here, so I thought I'd let them do. All right, today we're going to talk about networks, and internet, how you get internet at your house, peer-to-peer versus server networks, all sorts of really heavy stuff. As I said, if you get confused, definitely ask questions, because this is some pretty good, some pretty heavy stuff. Okay, a network is identified by the area it serves, how the data is stored, how the resources are managed, and how networks are organized. Does anybody have any examples of networks they use in their lives?
Is anyone awake?
Yeah, I'm awake. I talk on the phone quite a bit.
Yeah, that's the telephone network. The postal system is also a network. It goes through various postal facilities, and then a mailman brings it to your mailbox. You can also, in America, put a letter back into your mailbox with a stamp on it and have it taken across the network to somebody else. Interestingly enough, in Australia, they do not pick up from your mailbox. So it's only a one-way network transmission from the mailbox. Joseph, do you have any examples of networks that you use? Okay, we'll just move on. We'll talk about... Oh, okay. No problems. Okay. LANs are usually physically close together, but they're not necessarily so. A LAN refers to consistent local administration, so it's going to be run by the same network administrations. For example, a LAN can be a LAN can be a network inside of a building, or it could be across a campus of a university. So you've got the network that can be accessed from the dorms, but it is still administered by the university staff, so it's still a local area network. Now we have a WAN, a wide area network, and the best example of this is the internet. There are large companies that have wide area networks. Go ahead. I just got some echo back from somebody who I thought was trying to mic up. Okay. Some like AT&T or Quest, they have wide area networks that span the entire country for their employees. A WLAN is a wireless network. This can be just in one room or throughout an entire building with multiple repeaters and things like that so that it can be expanded. So a WAN, WAN, is a wide area network. A WLAN, wireless LAN, is a wireless network. Those can get confusing, so just remember, WLAN is wireless LAN, wireless local area network. WAN is wide area network, and that's very important to remember the difference because it is in your test. Okay, we're going to talk about peer-to-peer networking and servers. In a peer-to-peer network, you can only have 10 computers, otherwise it just gets messy and it's not very feasible to have the network. In a peer-to-peer network, each computer is responsible for what data or devices they're sharing. So there's no centralized administration. To that end, there's no centralized security. You're responsible for your own security. So each computer can have different security measures. The advantages to a peer-to-peer network is that they can be set up very easily. There's no cost, extra cost of equipment, such as a server, and there is no. You don't have to hire a system administrator to administer your peer-to-peer. Everybody's responsible for it on their own. The disadvantage is that it really isn't any good for over 10 computers. If somebody doesn't have their computer set up right, it can be a security risk, and each person has to manage their own sharing, so that can be a problem if somebody doesn't quite know what they're doing.
Can I just intervene for a sec?
Go ahead.
Thanks, Grace. If I remember rightly in the test, there were a couple of questions on this point. One was, what are the disadvantages to a peer-to-peer network? Obviously, security. And there's no centralized form of administration. And the other one, unless I'm mistaken, Windows machines, assuming we're talking Windows here, do only generally allow 10 connections, no more than 10 connections, unless you're talking about, you know, 2003 server or 2000 server and those sort of server-based you know, networking operating systems.
Right. No, they do only allow... they're only good for about 10 connections.
They're only good for about 10. And I think the real reason is actually more licensing. But, of course, if you were to... you know, put more on your peer-to-peer, you could, of course, find a degradation in performance.
To be honest with you, I've actually seen, we used to recommend 30 back in 95, and the actual practical limit is 30, but Microsoft has nobbled you at the knees with 10 connection limit for sharing, which is a Microsoft thing. They want you buying their enterprise operating systems.
Yep,
those are the...
Bring that point up, because I think it's in the test for memory, without having to sort of bring it all
it
up
is.
And check.
It's definitely in the tests, so those are the disadvantages. You also get a question on servers, which I'm going to talk about right now. The server is a centralized point where your files or printers or emails are stored. So all of the other computers are clients. They send requests to the server for information, and the server puts out the information to the computer if you have correct access. This is much more secure because it's one computer or one device with all of the information. You are not responsible for what's shared. You can put it onto the server, and the server will take care of it, and the server administrator will take care of it. They are more expensive. You do have to buy the server equipment. You do have to have someone especially to administer the server, because if you have a lot of people, there are too many cooks in the kitchen, and you will have administration problems. The good things about the servers are, as I said, the security, that all of the files are in one place, and all the printing and email is in one place. They're good for many, many computers. You can have a lot. I don't really think there's a limit to how many computers you can have on one server.
Yes, there is.
There, sir?
Yeah. It depends on the server. It depends on the network stack. It depends on the switch infrastructure you've got. There are actually limits on how many computers you can have on certain network switches. So there are limits, but you're probably not likely to hit them in the small sort of home networks that you're dealing with. But let's suffice it to say that if you have over 200 PCs on a local area network, things start to get a bit nasty.
Right, but there's no one hard number like 10 or 20.
Yes, there is. It depends on the server. Yeah, seriously, it depends on the server. We can't give you the number, but it will depend on which operating system the server is running and the necessary limits on that server's that server stuff. If you want to know about it, go listen to IT2 Module 12 Part 2, where we talk about bottlenecks. And that is up on the server. It will be up on the server later today if anybody's interested.
Okay. Does anyone have any questions about servers or peer-to-peer?
Would I be correct in assuming that the four computers that I have hooked up through my modem would be considered a peer-to-peer network connection?
Yes, if you can share files or services between them.
And if one doesn't necessarily act as a server for all the others. More than likely, because you have Windows XP, it's peer-to-peer.
My other point would be, and here's a question for you, Mark. What would happen if you wanted to connect a fifth computer on? What would you do? This is not in your test.
Well, at the moment, I would have to consider if I could do that or not, because right now my modem only has, well, actually, I could do that with wireless. I got all four of them hardwired with an Ethernet cable at the moment, but I could also have wireless, like a wireless modem, if the other fifth computer had a wireless modem on it, I suppose.
There is another way. You could also connect another switch to your modem, and you'll hear about switches later in this module, and give yourself another three or four computers, and you could have seven or eight hardwired in.
Okay, cool. I may have to consider that at some point.
All right, I'll let Grace get back to the lecture, but I thought I'd bring that up as an interesting point. You can actually daisy-chain switches, and you'll learn about what switches are perhaps later in the module a little bit. But yes, you can actually wire another switch in and connect more PCs hardwired into that switch.
Okay. We are going to talk now about network operating systems and networks, unless anyone else has any questions on peer-to-peer networking or servers. You know, I guess I have a question for you guys. can you guys think of any times when you guys have had to access any kind of servers?
Well, anytime you go on a website.
Absolutely.
Which I do pretty much daily.
I think we all do. any other times when you think applications on your computer might access a server?
How about right now? Yeah, I was just about to say,
I was going to say, wouldn't that, well, not on right now, but when my Dell is on and that's the computer that my printer's connected to and I can print from my HP, wouldn't that technically be accessing a server as well, or?
No,
that would be your peer-to-peer.
Alright. My mistake.
That's okay, but you have just answered your question about whether your network's peer-to-peer.
Well, that's always good.
Yeah. Alright. Moving on. All network operating systems do offer file and print services. Sharing information, collaborating on projects, and providing access to input and output devices are common services of computer networks. Network users can share more than information and special devices. They can also share applications, such as word processing programs, that are installed on the server. Users can run the shared applications from a server without using space on their local hard disks for the program files. There are many common services of computer networks that you will be able to find in your real lives. For example, Mark, you went to WSBH. I know for a fact that they had a network copy of Word, and you could use that on your computer. And you didn't have to have Word actually installed on each computer. Because if a network administrator had to go around and install Word on each computer, it would take time. Of course, there are
actually,
copies of...
No, sorry. I have to disagree here. You actually do have to install Word on all of the servers, even if it is running off a server. There is actually files that need to be on the local system. And in fact, you do have to do a workstation install of Word on every workstation. Sorry, and that holds for most network applications. There is the core DLLs and stuff that need to be on the local workstation. So no, Word does not run completely off the server, just so that everybody knows.
There are, however, some programs that do, but yeah, as Kerry said, Word's not one of them.
Okay, I was thinking...
Yeah, most of the Microsoft stuff actually does require a local installation. In fact, most of the programs for Windows, unless they're portable or specific network aware, do require the DLLs to be down in C Windows System 32, and that does involve in sort of a core amount of the program being dropped onto the local workstation. And Microsoft Office is certainly one of those ones where you have to drop 20 or 30 megs of stuff on the local workstation before it'll fly.
But you do not have to put the whole entire computer program on there, and you can easily deploy it using an image for each computer.
That's technically illegal. Yeah, no, Microsoft's actually technically made that, they've loosened up a little bit now, but no, you're not supposed to image it out, you're actually supposed to deploy it with the deployment tools, but that's not what this lecture's about, so we won't go into the why fors of that, but yes, technically, imaging your machines down is a violation of your license unless you have a corporate license.
Okay, because they did have a corporate whole user license, so I thought that that was okay to do.
No, and in fact Microsoft actually discourages it. What you're supposed to do is actually build the images and deploy them with SysPrep, because theoretically unless you have a corporate license you have to activate every individual PC and every individual copy of Office, and Microsoft actually discourages you from using imaging tools unless of course you're using their deployment suite at prodigious costs. Your organization would have had the corporate license because they probably would have come under non-profit or educational that Microsoft gives special discounts to. But if you're a regular business, you have to pay quite a bit for that sort of service. Just because it's illegal doesn't stop people from actually doing the re-image. I'm just pointing out the legality of it.
Okay. Yeah, we were non-profit, and that's what they did, and that's how they did it. They installed what did need to be installed via the images. That's how it worked.
Believe it or not, Grace, I did not know this. I mean, I knew they had their network, I knew they had all that stuff, but I just didn't know until you said something now that that's how they did it.
Yep, that's how they do it. They have a network copy of Word on their server, and I guess then they installed the little bits that did need to be installed on the local computer, and so Word ran off the service, and that's how it worked.
I got a real quick question though. Do they have like a specific disk that isn't the whole program but all the critical stuff that you'd need for each machine?
No.
Or does it have to be right off the disk that the program is on?
What you actually do is you actually take your Office CD and you actually do, you can either do this on the server or you can actually push this up from workstation. You do a setup slash A, which does an administrative copy of all the files off your Office media up onto the file server. And you then run the install of the Office from the server down onto the workstations. So the install files actually live up on the server. And there's quite a lot of documentation on Microsoft's website that will handle that particular topic, so we'd refer you there because we don't really cover that in our lecture today.
I may have to go over there and check it out sometime, but not today probably.
A network install of Office is not worth it for a home network, trust me. Just install it on the machines. It's for your own knowledge, it's worth doing, but you're going to give yourself more headaches trying to set up a network install of Office from a file server than you will by just installing it onto the actual workstations itself. Also, be aware that if you're going to have Office running concurrently on four machines, you must legally own four licenses for Office. So I'd be just installing it on each machine and using it as necessary.
Well, at the moment I'm using OpenOffice, the open source version of pretty much the same programs.
Okay, we're going to move on to wireless hotspots. A hotspot is where wireless access is available around a wireless access point. Hotspots can overlap, causing them to interconnect. You may see hotspots around coffee shops or restaurants. Some hotspots are free and you can connect to them. Other hotspots you have to pay for. When using a hotspot, be aware of security. Probably not the most wonderful idea to go buy that hot new computer on eBay or put your credit card into something, because it is a little bit of a security risk.
I do believe, I know for sure, Edgerton Library, and I'm pretty sure a whole bunch of libraries are doing stuff like that, putting the Wi-Fi and all that good stuff into their networks.
Not a good idea to put personal information on them.
No, not at all. Especially at those libraries. I said it's like exactly where the hackers go to sniff out information. But it's great for doing schoolwork and maybe checking email and all of that. And most libraries actually have wireless access points or places you can wire up and use the internet nowadays.
I think some bus terminals too. Like the actual bigger terminals, not just the bus stops.
But a lot of them you have to pay for. Which is okay, but I usually think about how long I'm going to actually be at the place and whether it's going to be worth it to actually get wireless access when I'm there.
Personally, I've never actually logged on in those particular places. Library is another story, but bus terminals, airports, nah.
I logged on to a hotel when I was there about a month and a half ago. Had to reconfigure my whole thing up because it wouldn't recognize the network that I was on. But
don't you love it?
That's enough to make the preacher cuss, much less his poor wife, ladies.
Yeah. It can be quite bad, and you could get charged quite a bit for it, too. So really read the... Oh, good. Well, when plugging into a public internet, especially at a hotel, read the terms of service. You may think that you are not being charged to connect, but sometimes you may be, and you just really want to be careful which checkboxes you checked and what's going to be billed to your room, all that sort of thing.
Check that anywhere, actually.
Especially before you ride the minibar.
Yeah, pretty much. Or the internet version of the minibar. Hotel wireless can be incredibly expensive. You're sometimes looking at, $2, $3,
$4 a minute. Oh, I know. We were lucky. We were in a place in country Victoria last year, a friend of mine and I, when we were on one of our trips, and he just asked for $5 a night. I gladly paid it. Gave me the key, and off I went. I was on Skype and the email and everything. I had a great time.
Absolutely. That's definitely worth it.
This was free, but it was slow. It was like 11 Mbps wireless.
Hey, that's faster than our internet, Jackie. Yeah, that's faster than our internet. It's faster than our internet. 11 Mbps.
I know, but actually, to be honest, it really messed up. It really messed up Skype. I was not doing well with my creative writing.
Your microphone level's a bit low, by the way, but just letting you know, that actually probably wasn't the wireless's 11 megabit fault. That was actually a contention issue because it was you and a whole lot of other people sharing the wireless. You probably would have found that 54 megabits per second would have had similar degradation of service because you were sharing the access point between a number of users. So it would have actually been the... because a wireless access point can only send or receive at any one time. So your issue was of contention, not speed.
You get what you pay for.
Well, actually, 11 megabit wireless will actually travel further than 54 megabit wireless, which is why they use it.
Okay, this is kind of a common sense thing here, but if you are to install any kind of network card, be it USB, be it a wireless card that you put into your computer, be it a modem, never install more than one driver at a time. You only want one on the system at a time, and don't install one driver for one thing and then another driver for another thing and then restart your computer, because if you have a problem, you're not going to know which driver gave you the problem. So only install one at a time and only have one driver active for a device at one time. Alright, we're going to go over, in very general terms, what a network is and the benefits of a network. The network consists of the equipment, media, and software that is required to connect two or more devices. Yes, you can have a two-device network. You may find that a network can be connected to many different types of devices, such as computers, printers, scanners, file and print servers. Some of the benefits of networks are that a network can share many different types of resources, such as the printers, scanners, hard or optical drives, and databases. You can have network storage, so you can, let's say you have a 40 gig hard drive, which some people may still have them. I still have them on this work machine. So I don't have very much space to store my lectures. So I will upload my lectures up to a file server, which has, let's say, a couple terabytes of storage, and when I want to access it, I can go ahead and listen to it via the network. Now it's not taking up my hard drive space, and I have space to put my Word documents and programs. Network devices link together using a variety of connectors. We have copper cabling, fiber optic cabling, or even a wireless connection, which we'll go over in a little while. Networks conserve resources. They avoid file duplication and corruption. They lower costs of licensing because when you get that Microsoft Office license for the 100 computers, it is a little bit cheaper than getting 100 individual licenses for 100 individual computers. You have fewer peripherals needed. If you're in an office of 100 people, each person doesn't need a printer on their desks. They might need one or two printers to do the job, and you won't have to pay for all the paper and all of the printer ink or toner, and you don't have to pay for maintenance on the one or two computers. Hey, you can even buy three or four so you have backups, but it's still not 100. Centralized administration. You don't have to worry about backing up your own files. Well, what if you don't know how to back up your own files? Your system administrator, if you've got a server, would be able to do that for you. Also, you might have virus scanning on the network, so less chance of viruses increase.
Actually, you still need it on the workstations.
But you can run it over the network, so you may not have to worry about running your own virus scanning software.
Wouldn't recommend it, because you'll actually chew up a lot more bandwidth by performing virus scans across the network. To actually scan a PC across the network, it chews up a hell of a lot of bandwidth. It's actually better to run both a server-based approach and antivirus on the workstations so that you're not trying to scan a whole hard disk full of stuff on all the workstations across the network.
This is probably true. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'm probably going to answer my own question here, but when you're scheduling the virus scanning for one or the other, the physical machine or the network, having them synced to run at the same time, would that conflict with anything, or I don't have to worry about it because I don't have a big enough network, but I was just kind of wondering.
With the network I'm thinking of, which is our lovely WSVH network, the virus scanners just went off at a certain time and were deployed at a certain time. I think via a command that was sent by the network to do it, and they scanned our machines, and that was that. So I'm really not sure.
It doesn't make a huge amount of difference. although obviously you'd like to keep the virus scan times away from when people are actually working on the workstations, because there is a there is actually a degradation in workstation performance whilst the virus scan is running. Also, you don't want the virus scans running on the server in peak load times, because the virus scan on the server will possibly slow things down a bit. So keeping those isolated and out of work hours is probably a good idea.
That's the same when you're on your own personal computer. I mean...
Absolutely.
I know this is a big difference when I'm on the internet or something and I'm scanning a virus scan is scheduled and I'm still running on browsing. It's a slow thing to deal with. That's just why I try to not be on the internet when I'm scanning.
That's probably an AVG-free problem. There are actually other virus scanners that have far less impact on your system as far as performance is concerned. What can I say, people? You get what you pay for. AVG-free is a good virus scanner, but it does have quite a large performance impact, and they certainly make no effort to optimize that for their free users at all.
No, they don't. I'm often find myself pausing the scan and starting it up later when I go and do something else when it comes on. Okay, now we're going to talk about bandwidth, and that is the amount of data that can travel across a network at the same time. The size of the bandwidth determines the amount of information that can be transmitted. Bandwidth is measured in bits per second, which is the abbreviated BPS.
Lowercase b.
Lowercase b, yes. We've got kilobits per second, capital K, lower b, PS per second, or megabits per second, and that is capital M, lower b, PS. Usually now, in America, your bandwidth is measured in megabits per second. And actually, I was seeing on Twitter that in Finland, they have made it a legal right that you have 1 megabit per second internet or more. Isn't that something? Yeah, I know, right?
I wonder if you still have to pay for it, though. I'd say you still have to pay for it. I think the fact that it's a legal right just means it needs to be available to you. I'd say you still get charged for it.
Probably, but I just saw that and
that's
I was like, wow. Well, if it's a legal right, especially in a country like Finland, if you're low income, they may provide it to you, which would be kind of cool.
Yeah, okay. That's true.
Okay, we are going to talk about the three types of transmissions. And funnily enough, they're talking about cars and roadways. So I had to smile at that. We're going to use some different examples, even though I know everybody knows about how the roadways work and all that. So the first mode of transmitting data is simplex. This goes only in one way. It is like a TV broadcast or a radio broadcast. When you listen to a radio or watch TV, that's simplex. It's only coming to you. You can talk back at the TV or radio, but it won't hear you, so you're not actually transmitting anything.
In fact, if you could actually hear what most people were talking back to their television, especially during sporting matches, you might have a lot of people put away for bad language and bad behaviour. So it's probably a good thing that your television can't, or especially the players, can't hear what you're telling them.
Yes, well, they do have some bans on certain things that you can say over the air. So, yeah, it's a good thing they don't transmit.
This is very true.
We'd all be fined for, the indecent language, and some of us would probably be fined for indecent exposure, because who knows what we're wearing when we watch our TVs. It's quite a good thing that that is a simplex method of transmission.
Yes, the thought of video phones are really scary.
Yeah, especially if you were on the cusp of the video phone and you forgot that you had the video phone with you. I mean, that could make for some interesting comedy there.
Actually, they have actually got situations where in most modern video phones you actually have to make a conscious effort to activate your side of the video to stop that problem from occurring.
I used to have video the ability to do video disabled because I was afraid that I would Skype somebody up and not realize the video was on.
Pick your nose.
Yeah, something like that. Okay, so we've got half duplex. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, and like Yahoo, and I did notice on Skype they have video too, but yeah, you do on Yahoo, you have to actually accept yes or no, or I accept or decline when you're going on a video chat deal, and a lot of programs, yeah. I believe, do that.
On Yahoo, given the average sort of person that jumps on Yahoo to do video, you'd probably want those yes-no buttons, because there's a lot of people you don't want to see, and you don't want to see what they're doing, especially on Yahoo.
Makes me kind of glad I'm blind.
Yeah, believe me, I've been in a few situations like that, and that window goes closed real quick on my end sometimes.
Okay, enough about illicit video. We're going to talk about something much more palatable, and that is half duplex. Now, can anyone think of any media that would allow you to do half duplex transmissions?
You haven't told them what it is yet.
No, I haven't. But let's see if they can guess. Because, come on, any media.
Like a two-way radio.
Yeah, or Ventrilo.
Ventrilo.
that was why I did that. Because half duplex allows data to travel in one direction or the other, but only at one time.
Actually, Ventrilo is full duplex. If you have headphones and speakers, it is absolutely possible for two of you to speak at the same time.
Yes, in that point, I agree.
So your two-way radios I'll take, but no, Ventrilo is actually full duplex.
Ventrilo, yeah. Okay. So you've got something like, two-way radio, or a walkie-talkie.
An amateur radio?
Oh, I thought those could be full duplex.
No, amateur radio is half duplex, unless you're doing, unless you're working a repeater, it's not a common configuration.
Also, citizen band. However,
you're still talking two-way radio, Mark.
You're still talking two-way radio.
Two-way radio.
Yeah.
Whether it's 11 meters or 80 meters, who cares? It's two-way.
Okay, so now we come to our full duplex, and that is, it can be Ventrilo if proper rules are not followed, and people talk over each other. I guess that is true. Skype is full duplex. You can definitely talk over each other. You've got just in-person meetings. You can definitely talk over each other there. It allows data to travel in two directions at the same time, but bandwidth is measured in only one direction at a time. This increases network performance, and most of the networks are like a telephone line is a full duplex network. Any questions on half or full duplex or our simplex? Okay. We're going to move on to IP addressing. So, every house on a street has a unique house number that allows you to get your mail. Just like every phone has a specific phone number to get calls. An IP address is a special number assigned to your computer that allows communication on the network. IP addresses are 32 binary numbers that is zeros and ones, but to make it easier for us to read, we put them into four octets. So a common IP address would be 192.168.2.1. We're now going to talk about the classes of IP addresses and also the question, how many bits in an IP address is on your test. That's 32 bits in an IPv4 address. They don't talk too much about IPv6 in this version of the course, so you guys are all right. If you see in this particular course the question, how many bits are in an IP address, it is 32 bits. Okay, we have Class A IP addresses, that is 1 to 127, the entire range. Each Class A IP address can have, each Class A network can have 16.7 million hosts, and the private IP range is the entire 10.0.0 subnet. So these IP addresses, logically, are only given to very large networks such as AT&T or Microsoft probably has one. Very, very, very large high-up companies.
Microsoft does not have one.
Really?
No, Microsoft is a Class B or a number of Class Bs.
Wow. Okay, so you have to be even bigger than Microsoft to get a Class A address. They're given out very sparingly. We've got the Class B addresses. These are 128 to 191. You can have 65,534 hosts on one of these networks. The private IP, private IP address is, the range is from 172.16 to 172.31. And this is mainly businesses that have these somewhat smaller. As Carrie said, Microsoft has a Class B network or several. We have our Class C addresses, and these are 192 to 223. You guys probably have seen these because 192.168 is the network for 192.168 is the private network addresses that you'll use. You can have 250.
Not necessarily. A lot of routers hand out 10 addresses, but a lot of people will have seen these. In fact, most of the routers I've seen that the ISPs deliver will tend to hand you out an address somewhere in the middle of the 10 pool.
You can have 254 hosts in that range. We've got Class D, which is broadcast addresses, and Class E, which is experimental addresses, and you're really not going to see many of those, if any. The main addresses that you guys will be working with are Class C addresses for small businesses and home use. The network ID is used for routing purposes. Go ahead. Okay. The network ID is used for routing purposes, while the host ID uniquely identifies each network interface on the network. In order for devices to know how to use IP addresses on the network, they must be able to tell which bits are used for each ID. So the dividing line is not predefined. It depends on the type of addressing used in the network and the subnet mask. Each network in an address class may have more addresses assigned to it than it needs. So administrators, very advanced administrators, will perform subnetting on their networks to make the networks smaller or larger depending on their needs. I'm going to go over the subnets for the classful subnets for each of the IP classes and how to identify the network portion. So for class A...
I was just going to say there is a worksheet on this, and when you do get to module 8, you will be actually specifying which of the classes the IP addresses belong to, so please refer to Grace's following explanation and your notes, because you will be using this.
And we'll try and do a couple examples, if you guys want to, of this, just to get you started and into the mind frame to do that worksheet. Okay, so we have class A, which is the subnet for that. If it's a classable subnet, it's going to be 255.0.0.0. So where there's a 255, that's going to be the portion of the IP address that's going to have the network. So if you have a network that has the IP address, say 12.24.136.1, the 12 is going to be the network portion. The rest of it's going to be the host. And there are, not that this really matters too much, 8 bits of network in a class A IP address and 24 bits of host. In a class B, we have 255.255.0.0. That's going to be 16 bits of network and 16 bits of host. Remember that the portion where the 255s are is going to be your network. So I'm going to give you guys an IP address here, and if somebody could tell me which bits would be the network and which would be the host, that would be really good. It's a class B address, so we're going to say 133.15.10.1.
Just out of curiosity, Grace, I'm wondering for a second, do you folks understand, do you students understand what a host is? Do you understand this?
Yeah, it hasn't actually been covered in the notes yet.
No, it hasn't. But a host is a device that is connected to the network. It can be a printer, it can be a computer. It's each device that is connected to a computer, or each
with
device that is connected
address.
To a network can be a host. Yes.
With an IP address.
Has to have an IP address, right? Or it could just be a device.
That is correct. This is an odd module, because basically this module sort of gives you a flying introduction to networks. It's critical information that you need to know if you're going to do anything with networks beyond plug them all into your plug-and-play router. But it does sort of give you a skimming overview of how networking works. I would encourage students who find this interesting to consider taking on Discovery 1 next year if they want to know more than what's in this chapter, because these are quite advanced topics that are really skimmed over quite quickly.
Absolutely, yeah, there's tons and tons and tons in this chapter. Do read your notes and read them pretty thoroughly, because this is quite a chapter, and we're trying to cover everything, but it's quite difficult to cover absolutely everything. And did anybody know which part that was the network, or and which part was the host portion of the IP address, or do I need to throw out another one and see if people can figure it out via the subnet mask?
Yeah, you lost me.
Okay, we'll just skip it.
Refer to your notes, guys. Go back through this lecture afterwards. Download the recording when it becomes available and listen through carefully. Yes, you do have to know this for the final exam, Mark, so no escaping it. And that goes for all of you. You all need to know it for the final exam, but you do have time to let it sink in. So we won't put you all on the spot at this particular time. Do refer to your notes. There is a worksheet in Module 8 that you will have to complete on this. And we will ask a few few questions about this next week and see if anybody can figure out which class an IP address is next week once they've listened to the lecture and referred to their notes.
Absolutely. Okay, that's a very good idea. And that's why we're doing it in 2 weeks, because some of the stuff does need time to sink in. So a Class C address has the subnet of 255.255.255.0, and that is 24 bits of network and 8 bits of host. And remember, the host bit identifies the device that is on the network. The network bit tells you which network it belongs to, so that you can find the network and then the actual host. Okay, any questions on that? I know it's really confusing.
I personally have quite a problem with this module because they don't give you an overview of binary. They don't really tell you what a bit is. And they certainly don't tell you how the subnetting functions. I'm going to have a look through this after the lecture and find out what actually comes up in the module exam and see how much of this we actually need to teach. So we'll go through the module as we're going to go through, but I'll actually see how much of it comes up in the test, because this does get a little complex.
It does, and there's some of it in the test, but it's important to know, and it's important to get an overview. Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess if we at least say to people that we've got 32, an IP address is 32 bits, we can divide it up into four chunks of eight, and each of those eight chunks are referred to as an octet, and we can take it from there.
Pretty much. That's the I know that the 32 bits is definitely in the exam, so you've got that going. That's for sure in the final, I remember answering it. It's for sure in the Module 8 chapter test. And I think you do get one question in the final, which is here's an IP address and subnet. Which one might this be? And you do get that. So all hosts within a LAN must use the same subnet mask, or else they're not going to be able to communicate with each other. That's very important, and I think that may be on the test as well. Okay, here's something that is also definitely on the test, and that is the DHCP server. As Jackie said, each host that's connected to the network has to have an IP address. Now, on a small network, the system administrator could go around and assign each computer the IP address, the subnet mask, and the default gateway manually. But after, 10-15 computers, this gets a little time consuming. So most routers have what's called, or servers have what's called, a DHCP, Dynamic Host Control Protocol. This will dynamically assign your IP address, your subnet mask, and your default gateway when you actually connect to the network, so that the administrator doesn't have to do it. This means that there are not going to be, there's a very much less of a chance of having duplicate IP addresses for each host, and the administrator doesn't have to keep track of each IP address. Very important to remember the three things that the DHCP server assigns, because this is on the test. It is an IP address, a default gateway, and a subnet mask. Those are three things that are usually assigned by a DHCP server. You can also get DNS servers from DHCP server.
You can get a lot of things from a DHCP server. We don't cover them. You can get WIN servers, DNS servers, time servers, boot P servers, location servers, all those sorts of things. But for your exam, you need to know that it hands out an IP address, a subnet mask, and a default gateway. It doesn't have to hand out a default gateway, but when they ask you in the test, that is the third one that they want.
Okay. So now we're going to go on to how computers communicate over networks. Does anyone think there are any rules when computers communicate over networks? You know, there are rules that we communicate when speaking. We try not to talk over each other. When we're actually speaking in person, we try to make eye contact with the person we're speaking with. There are greetings, and there are just different codes that we use in speech. When we write, we use punctuation. What if people didn't use question marks when asking a question? It would be very hard to tell when they were asking questions. So, computers use protocols to communicate. When a computers communicate, they must use the same set of rules or protocols. So, common sets of protocols that are used, the most common one, is the TCP/IP set of protocols, and we'll be going over that soon. Other ones are NetBUI, NetBIOS, IPX/SPX. We've got HTTP, which lets you access the web servers, HTTPS, which is secure web servers, FTP, which is file transfer protocol. We've got Telnet, POP, which is post office protocol that allows you to check your mail in Outlook Express, as well as IMAP. SMTP, simple mail transfer protocol, which allows you to send mail. Protocols, protocol functions are identifying errors, compressing data, deciding how data is to be sent, addressing data, deciding how to announce sent and received data. One protocol that is very important is Internet Message Protocol, that is ICMP.
That's Internet Control Message Protocol.
It is primarily used by devices to send error messages. ICMP uses the ping command for this task. It announces network errors. It will let you know when there is a network congestion, and ping is used for troubleshooting. It sends an ICMP echo request to determine whether a specific IP address is accessible. And I was going to run through an example ping so that you guys could see what happens when you ping an address. So, and I think I will actually just do that because real life examples are good. So I want people to press Windows R to pop up the Run dialog box. Okay, once we're in the Run dialog box, type in CMD and press Enter. Okay, once you're in the command prompt, type ping, P-I-N-G, space, as an example, www.cisco.com.
Oh, which won't reply to pings, but that's okay.
Well,
Or Google. Actually, yes,
yeah, cisco.com will. Cisco.net doesn't. Because that's the example we have in the book here.
We actually had one where the example didn't actually work when you actually went to try it, because Cisco had turned off ping since the text was published. However, that one does work, so cisco.com should return, and in fact, in my case, I had 25% packet loss. I only got 3 of my 4 packets back.
I happen to have gotten all 4 of them back.
Good
for
you.
Oh, good. Right on. So that's how to tell if a website is up or if you are up and able to get a network connection. If you can ping, say, cisco.com or google.com, your internet should be working properly, and you are getting packets out to a host, and you are receiving packets back. So always a good thing to know. Okay. Has everybody had enough, or would you like me to go on to network cables?
Yeah, it's probably a good break point.
Yeah, I seem to agree here.
Yeah, it's a little deep and there's a lot of stuff in it. So we will stop here. Any questions, comments?